Well, it's full speed ahead for Donald Trump's historic criminal trial. Is it a Titanic moment in the making? I'll explain. Also tonight, so many questions about this trial and how it'll all work on Monday. I'll be taking your calls and your questions live in just a few moments. Plus, our court of public opinion takes on one of the hottest topics in America today, DEI. Has it gone too far or not far enough? The debate tonight on Laura Coates Live. All right, now we're just 3 days away. Donald Trump's hush money trial, as it's often called, gets underway on April 15th. It'll share a page in the history books alongside something that happened 112 years ago on the very same day.
Is there anyone there?
Yes, what do you see?
Iceberg, right ahead!
I can't believe that's the same day. But the Titanic, it was considered unsinkable, the biggest, the best, the most luxurious. Sound familiar? It was not just unsinkable, it was unthinkable until the moment the Titanic ran up against that iceberg and sank on, you guessed it, April 15th. But instead of icebergs, Donald Trump has been navigating, well, indictments. And now he's coming up against one that could threaten to sink his presidential campaign, his criminal trial in New York. And remember, he's got to get off the campaign trail and sit in that courtroom. And with 3 days to go, it looks like, well, it's full speed ahead. Judge Juan Merchan tonight throwing out Team Trump's latest attempt to delay the trial of what they now claim is excessive pretrial publicity, which, by the way, may be the first and only time that Donald Trump has ever objected to publicity. Let's remember what this is all about. An alleged scheme in 2016 to pay off adult film star and director Stormy Daniels to stop her from speaking publicly about what she says when it's an affair with Donald Trump years before. You'll hear it called a hush money trial, but the charges are really about, as they state, falsifying business records to cover up the payments, which are felonies. Trump has pleaded not guilty. He has completely denied the affair ever took place. And tonight he announced that he would testify in that trial, though, I mean, it remains to be seen whether he actually would take the stand eventually. Meanwhile, he is making it very clear that he is focused on the jurors who have his fate in their hands.
You know, jury selection is largely luck. It depends who you get.
Well, now I want to bring in Renato Mariotti, a former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast. Also with us now, Marcus Childress, former January 6th committee investigative counsel. Gentlemen, I'm glad you're both here. Okay, he's calling a little bit of luck. I mean, luck be a lady, Lady Justice, I guess they should say. It's more than just luck, though. It's also about strategy and a number of other factors. Renato, let me begin with you here. Here's how Judge Juan Merchan responded to Trump's request to throw out the trial based, again, on publicity. And by the way, he cited Trump's two former New York trials, saying, quote, he was personally responsible for generating much, if not most, of the surrounding publicity with his public statement. So is there anything at this point now, Renato, first of all, left for Trump to try to do at this point to stop what's happening on Monday?
Well, I certainly wouldn't put anything past Trump. He's very creative in terms of finding ways to delay legal proceedings. But I just don't see it happening, Laura. I really think we are full steam ahead on Monday, to use your term. And that's really something, because obviously there's been a heck of a lot of delay in all of these legal cases against Trump. And now, for the first time, we're going to see the criminal trial of a former president.
How about the publicity statements he's making? I mean, the idea that it's core, he's trying to suggest he couldn't possibly get a fair or non-biased jury, right? If that's why the publicity issue is a problem for him.
I that's not going to delay the trial. He can make those arguments. It's smart for him to make those arguments. The judge is correct that he is partially to blame for that, because he's generating a lot of that publicity through his constant messaging about this trial and making that the center point of his campaign. The reality is that regardless of what a juror has heard about a case, as long as they testify and tell the judge that they can be fair and the judge believes that, and credits that, the judge is generally going to allow that to go forward, and it's not going to be reversible on appeal.
Marcus, let me turn to you here, because Trump is also saying tonight that he wants to testify. Listen to this.
You plan to testify in your trial in New York?
Yeah, I would testify, absolutely. It's a scam. It's a scam. That's not a trial. That's not a trial. That's a scam.
What are you watching as jury selection begins in New York?
Well, you know, jury selection is largely luck. It depends who you get. It's very unfair that I'm having a trial there.
All right, look, if you're D.A. Bragg, Marcus, would you want to see Trump on the stand?
Yes, I mean, it's like Christmas Day for any prosecutor when a defendant wants to take the stand, if we're being honest, especially when they have a public record of what former President Trump has of talking in public and making statements that aren't 100% factual. So I think the attorney, the DA Bragg, would be excited for the former president to testify. And I think this is part of the playbook that Trump always uses, that he always says he wants to talk or he wants to go out and tell the truth. He said he wanted to talk to the January 6th committee. We gave him a subpoena to come talk. He never came and talked. And we saw how the former president did when he took the stand just a couple weeks ago and a month ago in another trial, right? It didn't go so well for him. And so, look, if you're DA Bragg or any of the attorneys working on this case, I think you are licking your chops at the opportunity of the former president to take the stand, because you have so much material to be able to impeach him with and to really undermine his credibility for truthfulness, which is the key if you have a defendant testifying.
I mean, when you say impeach, people think about the political part. You're talking about impeaching, maybe I can point out why you are not telling the truth in front of a jury to undermine your credibility in the courtroom. Renato, a lot of familiar faces are expected to actually testify in this case. And one of them, Michael Cohen, speaking to Politico about testifying, says this, quote, "I'm not even expected to be one of the first witnesses. I'll probably be more like in baseball, cleanup. I'll be like a fourth or a fifth batter. They're going to keep me on that stand for as long as they possibly can, trying to discredit me." I want you both to weigh into this, but I'm going to ask you this, Renato. Does it make sense to you to have Cohen as one of the later witnesses to testify?
Yeah, so usually if you're a prosecutor, you want to put your most problematic witnesses in the middle of the case. Mm-hmm. Jurors usually pay the most attention to what happens at the very beginning and at the very end. So you want to get off to a very solid start to your case. You don't want Michael Cohen and scathing cross-examination to be the first thing that they see about your case. And the last thing that before they go into the jury room and close and have closing arguments, you want that to be solid as well. You don't want your case to end on a bad note. So usually your flipper or whoever the questionable witness is, and there's certainly a lot of material to work with in terms of Michael Cohen, you put him, you know, right in the middle of the case, and cleanup is pretty much in the middle of a batting order. So that's about right.
Well, just for the record, on CNN, Laura Coates Live is the closer. Thank you very much. Marcus, I want to ask you this about this theory from former federal prosecutor Ankush Kardori. He writes this, the Trump team could, quote, ask the judge to give the jury the option of convicting him on lesser misdemeanor offenses instead of that felony counts that have actually been brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and his team of prosecutors. Is that a legitimate strategy to you?
I think it's a legitimate strategy and something that defense counsel frequently do. I mean, I saw it in my experiences when I was prosecuting cases, was that a lot of times if the evidence was strong, you would see defendants argue for the lesser included charge, as you just said. And here, that would just be falsifying the records to defraud rather than falsifying the records, you know, to aid or conceal another crime such as campaign finance laws or tax laws. And so, look, I think it could be smart, because anytime you can bring those charges down to a misdemeanor versus a felony, that's a smart play. But the former president has a different calculus here, where he may be looking just to not have any type of state conviction attached to his name at all. And so it'll be interesting to see which path he takes. But I think for the most ordinary defendants, they would probably go for that lesser included and argue that rather than face the felony conviction.
And don't forget, the judge did not bring the charges. It's really the prerogative of the prosecutors. They have to have some buy-in to this as well. Renato, Marcus, stick around, because there are a lot of questions about this trial. And tonight, you know, we're doing something a little bit different. We're going to answer them live, not just from our different discussions and people who've just seen, but your questions. So if you want to participate, just go to cnn.com/Trump Trial Questions. You fill out the form, you type in your question there, and then we'll reach out to have you call in as the trial unfolds. Let's go to our first caller of the night. We've got James from Dublin, Ohio. James, what is your question?
Thank you for the opportunity, Laura. My question is, will Trump be present during voir dire?
That's a good question, and I'll take the first stab at it. So in a criminal case, James, the person who is the defendant must be present in the state of New York. And so this is a part of the trial, the voir dire process. He has to get off of the campaign trail and be present for the duration of it. Now, how long it takes will be anyone's guess. But in a high profile trial in particular, it can be lengthy to try to get that final 12 plus alternates to sit and have that unbiased view from both the prosecution and the defense side. So it'll be very telling how long he is there ultimately. Let's go to our next question here. We've got Chris from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Chris, what's your question?
Good evening, Laura. Thanks for taking my question. I am wondering, if Trump is convicted, what is his most likely sentence?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to have Marcus, why don't you focus on that one as well? What is your reaction?
If I heard the question right, look, his most likely, was it a punishment, I believe is what it said, or sentence? Like, I think it would be like home probation or something of that nature. Like, you could look at the charge here. There's no victim per se. It's not a violent crime. The former president doesn't have a history of criminal convictions here. So I think it's more realistic if you look at how courts wouldn't typically rule in these type of white collar cases, where you're looking at maybe home confinement or probation of some period of time. Plus, you got to consider he's a former president. So there might be some logistical, actually not might, there will be some logistical concerns with putting him in jail per se. So that's what I would think would be the likely sentence.
I agree. I mean, and also remember the maximum penalty for each of the charges, I think it's like 4 years, but New York caps everything to 20 years. And so if he were convicted on all the counts, facing more than a decade. But as Marcus talks about, the judge has to consider a number of factors, including their criminal history and, of course, the practicality of what you would do in the equal treatment of the law to have somebody convicted of a crime not serve time if others in that position would, and being the president of the United States. There's a lot of ifs there, and he's got the presumption of innocence so far. Alyssa from Matawan, Michigan, what's your question?
Hi, thank you, Laura. Can Trump's attorneys delay the trial by claiming all candidate jurors are biased during jury selection?
Hey, that's a great question, Alyssa. And certainly he has had a field day in all the different motions that he has filed trying to delay it. But, you know, today is Friday, and at the end of Friday, this jury selection will start on Monday. That's not opening statements, remember. That's the jury selection. So he could still have some bites at the apple, potentially, to try to suggest he wants to delay. Renato, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be able to delay the trial via attacking a particular bias amongst a juror. He could potentially challenge a juror for cause when they're answering questions during voir dire. But if the judge disagrees, he'll have to use one of his 10 peremptory challenges, one of his 10 strikes to get a juror off. And I don't really see any way in which he'll be able to use that as a method of delay.
And remember, for cause, right, Renato, is something that is a legitimate reason to show definitively that the person could not follow the law. But the peremptory could be for any reason they want on both sides, right? It could be they don't like the way you looked at them. They don't like your T-shirt that day. That could be something they could use as long as it's not for an illegitimate purpose like race or gender or otherwise, right?
Absolutely. Exactly.
Well, we'll see how that turns out. We've got more questions. Catherine, Catherine, what is your question? Where are you calling from?
Redwood Valley, California.
Oh, wonderful. What's your question, Catherine?
Hey, it seems that Trump is allowed to appeal each and every decision. Is this normal procedure for any defendant?
You know, we are seeing in real time what a lot of people don't always experience, and that is that a defense counsel will zealously try to defend their client based on the motions and trying to do everything they can to avoid a trial or to get the case dismissed outright. And so you are seeing a lot of this come to fruition. The number of similar, though, and redundant motions, Marcus, I think is really telling here. What's your take?
Yeah, I think, look, it's the former president that's filing these motions. And so there is a lot of attention and probably patience given by the court for each of these motions, where in real practice with other defendants, it might just be ruled on the on the papers, or a judge might just reject the motion from the bench and just say simply like a motion denied. I think because it is former President Trump and this is such a high stakes trial, you're seeing a lot of due care given to each motion, even though it is ultimately denied.
I think that's a great point. And now let's go to Tom from Raleigh, North Carolina, the Research Triangle of the United States. They say, what's your question?
Oh, thank you. Are prosecutors able to question Stormy Daniels about personal physical aspects of their alleged affair, such as physical features, unique identifiers, to dispute Trump's claim that he didn't have sexual relations with her? It seems to me that the more ironclad proof of the affair is, the more it demonstrates premeditation and intent in falsifying records and covering up.
That's a great point. You know, Stormy was on The View recently. Listen to what she had to say, by the way, about being ready to testify to these different aspects of it.
I'm absolutely ready. I've been ready. I'm hoping with all of my heart that they call me, because as I showed on the stand against Michael Avenatti, no one, I don't need someone to speak for me. Mm-hmm. And I relish the day that I get to face him and speak my truth.
Well, I'll be curious to see how much the judge allows of these questions. Remember, every question has to be weighed, which is called the probative versus prejudicial value. And probative really meaning, does it go to the heart of the matter, the crimes, the allegations that are actually before this jury? While we all would like to hear the salacious, well, maybe we all would not like to hear the salacious details, is up to you. The idea that the judge will have to really toe the line to suggest and confirm that this is actually about the case. And there also could be arguments made that the prosecution would have enough evidence to support their claims, even separate and apart of the actual allegations of an affair were true or not. Seems to me the closer you have to focus on, if you are the defense or prosecution, on proving an affair, the further away you are from the falsification of business records, although it does have what they call probative value with respect to what the motivation for paying her would be. But if the allegations alone would be enough to suggest a payment would be necessary, perhaps that's enough for the judge to let it all in. Renato Marquez, thank you for helping to answer these viewer questions. And thank you to everyone who called in. Really, really thought-provoking questions. I love that you've done so. If you have a question you'd like us to answer on the upcoming Trump trial, listen, we'd love to hear from you. So just submit your questions at cnn.com/Trump Trial Questions. That was really fun to talk to all of you from across the country. Hey, it may be the issue that President Biden is hanging his campaign on, and his VP is on the front line on the abortion battle tonight, taking aim at, well, Donald Trump.
Trump wants us to believe he will not sign a national ban. Enough with the gaslighting.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
It's one of the biggest flashpoints in the 2024 election. It's playing out in a split screen. Former President Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris addressing abortion head on. Trump saying that a federal abortion ban is no longer needed. But Harris warning Arizona voters Don't be hoodwinked.
We don't need it any longer because we broke Roe v. Wade and we did something that nobody thought was possible. We gave it back to the state. You have some cases like Arizona that went back to like 1864 or something like that. And a judge made a ruling, but that's going to be changed by government. They're going to be changing that. I disagree with that.
And now Trump wants us to believe he will not sign a national ban. Enough with the gaslighting. He basically wants to take America back to the 1800s.
So who to believe? Well, I mean, Trump's track record on abortion has been anything but predictable, shifting more than, what, a dozen times over the past 25 years. And Trump today was asked this.
Over the last few decades, Mr. President, you have both considered yourself pro-choice and pro-life. Which one is it?
Well, you know exactly which one it is.
The thing is, you didn't actually say which one it is, and there are questions about which one it is, hence the question that was asked. I want to bring in CNN political commentator Van Jones and CNN senior political commentator Scott Jennings. Gentlemen, first of all, I already see Van shaking his head, and I see Scott leaning in with a smirk. This is about to be good. Let me start with you, Scott, for a second here, because that wasn't actually a hard question to answer, and he danced around it. I mean, can he have it both ways, and what is the answer?
Well, yeah, you can. I mean, Joe Biden's had it about 40 ways in his career. This guy's been on every side of this issue, too. Everybody's, you know, worried about Donald Trump's position, but Joe Biden has had a shifting position here. I think Trump's telling us the truth about the national ban issue, and Harris is not being truthful. Here's why. There is no chance the United States Senate could ever muster 60 votes for any kind of abortion legislation of any kind. And so the reality is all of this is going to take place in the states, just as Trump has said. And that's what we're seeing play out right now. So I'm not surprised to see the Biden campaign using it. It's the only issue in which they have an advantage over Trump. They've lost every other issue. But the truth is, there is no national regime coming. There is no national ban. There is no restoration of Roe versus Wade, as Biden has promised. Everything that's going to happen is going to happen at the state level.
Van, what's your take?
Good try.
You know, I appreciate you trying. First of all, Trump was tap dancing on banana peels, bobbing, weaving. I mean, he looked terrible. He looked like the defendant in chief once again, and Kamala Harris looked like the prosecutor in chief. I hope people will search for that speech. She was fantastic, and she was factual, and she whooped him, she spanked him. And here's reality: Donald Trump doesn't have to go through the Congress. He could appoint somebody to be the head of the FDA that just bans all of the medical abortion pills and kill it that way. You cannot trust Donald Trump on abortion. You can trust the Biden-Harris regime on abortion. It's really, really clear. But if you want to see the split screen, watch Donald Trump's completely ridiculous conference today, trying to have it every which way but loose, and watch Kamala Harris press the case. Kamala Harris was fantastic. She was the prosecutor in chief today, and Donald Trump looked terrible.
Well, let me ask you, here's a split screen, by the way, and while we're on this, a split screen maybe at a debate, on a debate stage. I mean, a lot of people, we all know that we've become accustomed in a presidential election year to seeing that. The Trump campaign is calling for much earlier debates between Trump and Biden. You see the calendar as it's set right now, increasing the number of face-offs between the two before Election Day. Is that a fair request, Scott, to have that happen?
I don't know if we need any more debates. I certainly wouldn't be opposed to it. I don't know if we need them. I do think they need to be earlier, so I agree with that. I think if you're going to have a month or 6 weeks or 8 weeks of voting or whatever it is people want these days, you have to have these things earlier. I mean, now you have these debates in October, and a lot of people have already voted. Certainly, most people have already made up their minds. So I would wholeheartedly support moving up the debates in the calendar to give the American people the chance to see these two guys debate each other before anybody has a chance to cast a vote.
Well, I mean, I wonder, in your opinion, Van, are these debates still as necessary? Are they still, or have they been rendered obsolete in some respect? And we obviously know that Biden is yet to commit to debating Trump. He hasn't ruled it out. He's saying in March it depends on Trump's behavior, which you might take issue with. Are you going to debate or are you not going to debate, Mr. President? But let me ask the question, is the debate as important as it once was?
I mean, it's hard to know, but if I were Biden, I'd say, listen, Donald Trump has a policy of not debating Republicans. So I'm not going to do it either. I mean, in other words, Donald Trump didn't debate a single human being. There were a bunch of people ran against him. He didn't want to show up for the debate. Joe Biden actually has a real job called running the United States. Trump's job is to go to court and try not to go to prison. Both of them might be a little bit busy to do a whole bunch of extra debates. I hope they do debate, but, you know, it's part of it is going to be such a circus. The last time Donald Trump debated, one of the times he showed up, he was full of COVID. He was acting like a lunatic. So
well,
you can imagine why the commander-in-chief.
I want to walk down memory lane. I mean, I just want to remind people, because they have debated before. I don't want to cut you off, but just listen to this, how it went last time.
Yeah.
The question is, the question is,
the radical left.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
who's
is
on
so
your
list? Right.
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's
going to
pack the court.
We're
not going to give a list.
I mean, I remember that quite well. Both of you, I mean, I see the reactions on your faces. Let me ask my question again differently, Scott. Do we need that again?
I do think we need it. These two guys need to debate each other. They need to show the American people some engagement here. And, you know, in the last election, I thought Biden won the first one, probably the second one. Trump, I think, won the third one. But this time of the round, they're 4 years older than they were. I think we need to see them together. It makes a lot of sense.
Van, what do you think?
Hey, look, I think it's fine for them to debate. Probably once would be enough. Like I said, I mean, the last time Donald Trump, not only did he show up screaming, yelling, act like a lunatic, he also was full of COVID and got a bunch of people sick, almost killed Chris Christie. I mean, I can understand why if you're trying to run a country, you may not want to be in a room with this guy. Look, I'm sure they'll get in there. Everybody will underestimate Joe Biden. They think he's going to go in there. He's going to pee on himself. He's going to fall over dead. And Biden will do a great job and Trump will be his normal self. And then we'll move on from it. But
is
I don't think
really,
he can do
is
it
that
three, four,
base?
Five, six times.
is that the road to standard?
That's what always happens. That's what always happens. People say, oh, Biden is going to do so terrible. He can barely walk. The Republicans set him up perfectly by lowering the bar. And then he goes and does great. And then we all applaud and move on. I'm saying, I think it's perfectly fine to do one or two. But I don't think we need a bunch of them. I think Trump is just doing that to try to prosecute his idea that, you know, Biden can't, you know, couldn't stand up to him. It's a part of Trump's psychological warfare. It's not a real plan.
Well, whenever it happens, I need both of you doing play-by-play, and I want the camera on your faces for the entire thing. I need a lot of memes to come out of it. Van Jones, Scott Jennings, thank you both so much. Well, here's a big question that might be debated and is continuing to debate. What is diversity, equity, and inclusion, and why do people find it so divisive? Up next, a debate over whether DEI has gone too far and what our court of public opinion, there they are, thinks about all of it.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Well, now we're turning to our own court of public opinion, our virtual courtroom where our in-studio audience will weigh in on the big questions of the day. And tonight, one of the hottest topics in businesses, legislatures, and college campuses all across this country. Three letters, DEI, short for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, you've probably come across it at work or maybe in school. In 2023, 52% of employed U.S. adults said they have had DEI trainings or meetings at work. We do here at CNN as well, of course, and critics call DEI discriminatory. They say it's nothing but an attempt to solve discrimination against people of color by discriminating against other groups, particularly white Americans. But supporters say DEI, which has been around for decades, is being weaponized politically and misrepresented. Since 2023, 82 anti-DEI bills targeting programs at colleges have been introduced in 28 states and in Congress. Eight have been signed into law in states like Texas and also Florida. Well, tonight, the question for our court of public opinion, has DEI gone too far? We'll hear from Coleman Hughes, the host of the Conversations with Coleman podcast and the author of The End of Race Politics. Also here, Sophia Nelson, a CNN opinion contributor and the author of E Pluribus One, Reclaiming Our Founder's Vision for a United America. Then our audience will weigh in. This is a diverse group of everyday Americans meeting tonight for the first time to share their opinions with each other and you. And I'm as interested as all of you are to hear just what they have to say. But let's begin our conversation now with those who are going to argue both sides of the position. Let me begin with you both. How do you define DEI? Coleman?
Yeah, so DEI in the past 10 years, it's not really your father's DEI. It's an ideology that is new, which divides the world into oppressed groups and oppressor groups. And it says whites and Jews are oppressor groups, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, depending on the day. And it judges you by your group membership, promotes race-based policies like affirmative action over race-neutral policies, and does not tolerate dissent. It considers any disagreement to be off limits. So this is what has crept out into DEI departments in colleges, in corporations, over the past 10 years. And what you're seeing in the recent backlash is really a backlash against the people who enforce this particular ideology on sectors of the American public.
Sophia, how do you define it?
DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion is, I think, something that, as he says, probably in the last 10 years has absolutely overreached. But DEI at its core, everybody's for diversity, everybody's for inclusion, Laura, but nobody wants to deal with that word equity. And that's what this is really about from a historic point of view, whether you're dealing with affirmative action and where we've come from there. As Bill Clinton once famously said, mend it, don't end it. That's how I feel about DEI. We have to deal with this restorative justice piece. I do agree with Coleman that what has happened, unfortunately, on college campuses in particular, is it has become a very rigid set of rules, statements, and policies that if you move left or right in those and you're not lockstep in line, you'll find yourself in a lot of trouble. And we know that I experienced that firsthand. So I say all that to say that I think I really want to focus on the equity piece of it, because diversity and inclusion is the easy part.
But even, well, is it, first of all, the easy part, diversity and inclusion? Because, Coleman, I think you've presented statements in the past where you think that it's, if it's forced diversity, it's actually antithetical.
Right, yeah. So I mean, in my view, diversity is like love. If it happens naturally, it's the best thing in the world. But if it's forced, you've kind of missed the point. And so the question, say you're a corporation, right? And you want more racial diversity. The question is, how do you get that? Do you get that in a way that is consistent with merit-based hiring? For instance, by just casting your net much wider in terms of job applicants, that's totally healthy. That's a good thing. Or are you doing this thing where you say, well, we need a black person or Hispanic person for this job, so we're going to grab this person regardless of whether they're prepared for this job, right? That's too much of what DEI has been. So someone like Roland Fryer, who's a Harvard economist, what he does is he actually looks at corporations, gathers data on them, and tells them statistically whether they have a bias in one direction or the other. And the NFL hired him to do this, and he was able to give them really legitimate feedback about where they don't have biases, where they do have biases. And that actually allows you to act in an evidence-based way. That's what DEI should be.
But DEI, the way you just described it, presumes it's a quota as opposed to an ideology. Which is it?
I have an issue with this word merit-based, because the presumption is that every white male that has a job in the Fortune 500 got there because of merit, or every white male or white female, as it were, in the corporate sector, in the academic sector, they all got there because they were qualified and had merit. But anybody with my skin color or with another color or from another group, somehow they took something that was somebody else's and they didn't have merit. That's a problem. You got to look at the data. He's right about what he says in the sense of how we cast those nets. But it goes back to restorative justice, as I said, and restorative equity. When you have systemic racist structures for 300 years of slavery, 100 years of Jim Crow, it is fool's gold to think that in 50 years you're going to eliminate all that and everything's going to be equal. And that's the problem I have with this debate. We're ignoring history. We're ignoring data.
I think we're confusing issues. DEI, once you get to the point where someone is 25, 30 years old and you're deciding whether to hire them or not, that's not the moment to introduce race-based decision-making. The problem you're talking about is completely real, but it has to be dealt with at the 0 to 18 level. K through 12 education has to be improved. We have to level the playing field at that level rather than tilt the playing field at the top level and imagine that we're doing something beneficial. The problem starts when you're a kid, right? It starts with intergenerational poverty, bad schools, and that's where the focus should be. And then once people are adults, we should judge them without regard to race.
Is diversity synonymous with class?
Look at the wealth gap in this country. Again, the data doesn't lie. African Americans will take 200 years to catch up as of today with just the basic wealth gap of savings, investment, ownership of homes, whatever, on the most base level. 200 years to catch up, and we're going to talk about K through 18, and you see what I mean? It doesn't work.
Real quick, I want to hear from both of you in your concluding statements about how you course correct based on your positions. Coleman?
So course correcting for DEI, I think it looks very much like what someone like Roland Fryer is doing. If you're a corporation, you want to have a DEI program, sure, but it should not be an ideological litmus test. It should not be signing a loyalty pledge to apply for a job, which it is at many universities. It should be a serious evidence-based look at the composition of your company to see if you have a bias in one direction or the other or one of many directions. Do it seriously or don't do it at all.
Sophia?
We have to rethink it, reimagine. And I want to be inclusive. I think white men have to be at the table. I think all groups have to be at the table, because if we're not talking e pluribus unum out of many one, we're not solving this problem together.
Very fascinating arguments from both of you just now. Coleman and Sophia, thanks for making the arguments you've made. I do wonder what everyone is thinking. Stick around, because we're going to turn to the jury and get them to weigh in on what they've heard and what they think about it. Back in a moment. Well, we're back in our court of public opinion. We've been discussing diversity, equity, and inclusion programs across the United States. We just heard a pretty lively discussion with Coleman Hughes and Sophia Nelson. So now I want to bring in our group of everyday Americans who have all had very different perspectives on DEI and see what they heard today. Let me begin with you all, and thank you for being here. I wonder what arguments stood out to you on either side of the issue. What's your thought? Juror number two.
So Sophia mentioned inclusion. I think that DEI truly is a very complicated topic, right? But with inclusion, you can hire as many minorities as you want. But if we're not getting a seat at the table, it doesn't really matter. So I think the DEI really needs to concentrate on inclusion as really the basis for what we're looking for.
You're nodding.
I think that inclusion can encompass many different things, as well as sexual orientation or disabilities, too. And I think that those are really vital voices to bring to the table. Just like your number two was talking about.
Are they part of the conversation?
I had some questions about her description of merit. She had some criticisms of the way that, you know, maybe somebody of color is seen as only have gotten that job because they are a person of color.
What are your questions? You can ask them here.
Well, I'm very curious then, what is the point of the merit system, right? It seems like when you start asking those questions, that actually is what puts those thoughts into people's head. Well, if we are requiring people to have a quota and we're rejecting the merit system, is that not then, by and large, forcing people to then think those thoughts?
I am 1,000% for merit, because everything I have gotten has been because of merit. What I don't appreciate are the arguments that what I've gotten is because I'm black and I'm female and I don't deserve it and I took someone else's spot who did deserve it. That's the discussion in the public forum right now. And that's divisive, it's harmful, and it's ugly. And I think there's a presupposition there, Laura, that it belongs to somebody else. It's just like when people say, I'm taking my country back. From who? What does that even mean? What are we talking about?
Can I say something to that briefly, too? I mean, I think we have to be honest about the fact that DEI programs and affirmative action have been a rejection of merit in favor of race-based admissions in some cases and hiring. I mean, this was proven in the case of Harvard, that your race was equivalent to, you know, several hundred points on the SAT, and that if the same candidate, if they were Asian, would not get in as opposed to if they were black. That may have affected me in my life too. I have no idea if there's certain jobs that I might have gotten because I was black, and I don't think the employer would ever tell me. And this is one of the signals that we're uncomfortable with it, is that we can't admit that it's even a real thing.
Well, the idea of the affirmative action discussions and the plus factors and the evolution of these case law is certainly something still in the public square. What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of what Coleman said made sense to me. And what one of the questions I had was, if we have DEI now, Why do we also have discrimination laws on the books? What are those doing? And what's the purpose of having both?
Is there a redundancy to you all?
On a university campus, I'm very suspicious. If the DEI office didn't come to college tomorrow, would anyone notice? How long would it take for anyone to notice that they weren't there? I know what the professors do. I know what the admissions department does. I know what the administrators do. I know what the janitors do. I'm not really sure what the DEI office does other than get involved in the occasional cancellation.
The reason you have DEI goes back to what I said at the beginning. You're trying to put together a systemic structure in place in your company, in your college, wherever it is, to say, we're not doing well bringing in people of color or LGBTQ plus or whatever. We want a diverse student body. We want a diverse company. So we're trying to put in structures into place that welcome those groups and make them feel welcome.
Let's expand the concept of DEI beyond just the idea of hiring and the actual composition of the student body or, of course, the job force, and also talk about the idea of the education, this different curriculum and beyond that's also part of the conversation. When you were hearing discussions about merit or hearing discussions about quotas as it's been articulated, what was your reaction?
In DEI, someone always loses, it seems like. Asian Americans brought that affirmative action case to the Supreme Court because they were losing out on scholarships and positions at incredible universities. And so that to me seems like the hardest part of DEI is that someone decides that someone loses. And even in women's sports, right? Women lose in favor of trans women earning those trophies. And so that's, I think, the hardest part for me.
So you all see DEI as synonymous with affirmative action. Is that right? And hearing the arguments being raised?
I don't know. I thought affirmative action was much more codified in law, and DEI is much more of a PR campaign or a way to, you know, identify some program with a university or a workplace.
And I disagree with that because there's a case in Florida where when they took DEI off the campus, so many students felt like they weren't included anymore. And the optics of losing that and taking it off campus, so many students were upset about that it was a place for them to feel comfortable when they went to the DEI office, and now it's gone. And so those students feel rejected, they feel left out, they don't feel a part of the school anymore because that office is gone now.
Do you see the idea of DEI that someone always must lose? You heard juror number three.
I don't think that someone always must lose, but I think that there's only things to gain, especially what juror number two was saying about students having that place to go to feel included. I was recently part of a college campus, and I did see how much that really impacted all of my fellow peers and how it meant a lot to them to have somewhere to go. Even if it wasn't necessarily something that you could point to say, here's a statistic, here is exactly how X, Y, and Z, this number of students benefited this way, this number of students got this many jobs because of what we have been providing them with. It's more of the feeling that they got. And I think that mental benefit was, yeah, for sure.
Is there a way for DEI to be corrected or improved based on your understanding of what it is?
Well, certainly we shouldn't be having trainings at work where they say that we're training people to how to be less white. Coca-Cola had that example a couple years ago. So certainly that didn't make people feel good. That did not make you feel included.
I've been in several trainings at my corporate, and I've never heard of them saying being less white. I don't think that's necessarily what the training is meant to be. I don't think that
shouldn't be, certainly. But Coca-Cola did do that. So we shouldn't have that anywhere.
Let me ask, I'm going to go down the line with each of you here and just ask, do you feel, and I know it's self-reflection, that you have an understanding of what DEI is for across the board? Yes or no?
Yes.
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 And I know I'm hesitating because I think the purest form of DEI is so different than DEI in practice. Mm-hmm. And so
what is the difference to you?
DEI in its purest form, I think, is a lot of what Sophia was saying. And I think that the purest ideals are exactly what America is all about. And in practice, it is so bastardized and has become so harmful and used as a weapon.
Four, my tally continues. Do you feel you have an understanding of what DEI is?
I don't know, because it seems like it's changing and shifting every day in the news, and it seems like it was branded to sound like something people would love to support. However, when put in practice, I don't know if it's what people want.
I'm really fascinated by all of your takes on this and the infusion of how the media and society, corporate America, and the educational institutions all weigh in on all of it. Thank you, all of you. And thank you to, again, Coleman Hughes and Sophia Nelson. And special thanks, of course, to our jurors in the Court of Public Opinion. Hey, if you'd like to be a juror in our next Court of Public Opinion, just get in touch with us by filling out the form you can access by scanning the QR code that's on your screen, or you can email us at lauracodesjury@cnn.com. Thank you for watching. Our coverage continues.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.